You're tuned in to More Living with Jim Brogan, broadcast live from the Brogan Financial Studios at News Talk 98.7, where old-fashioned values, expert knowledge, and genuine understanding come together to give you the retirement straight talk you deserve. Jim's a former National Advisor of the Year recipient and a financial educator, and he's here today to talk about how you can live out the best years of your life. Jim and the Brogan Financial team have been helping retirees and pre-retirees across the Southeast for over 20 years in their pursuit of financial independence. You can reach them during the week at 865-862-6800. So sit back, relax, and get ready to learn, because More Living with Jim Brogan starts now.
Good morning. Welcome to More Living with Jim Brogan, where it's all about living the best years of your life your way. As this is News Talk 98.7 WOKI. And you know what? Do we have an emergency department crisis in our emergency rooms across the United States? We know we have a lot of challenges with healthcare in general, but what about our emergency rooms? You know, emergency departments provide immediate care for patients with urgent medical needs, which can range from minor injuries to life-threatening conditions. And they're equipped to handle a wide range of emergencies, including trauma, cardiac issues, respiratory problems, and acute illnesses. Emergency departments also play a crucial role in disaster response and are a vital part of our healthcare system, offering access to care when other options are limited. But like so many areas of medicine, they are facing challenges: overcrowding, staffing shortages, and a lot of financial pressures. Our guest today is physician and author Dr. Carrie Forrestal. Dr. Forrestal is a practicing physician in emergency medicine with a medical degree from Stony Brook University. He also holds an MBA and served in the Air National Guard. He was on with us in the spring. We were talking about his book, Crushing Cancer. Good morning, Dr. Forrestal. Welcome back to More Living.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm doing just great. It's great to have you on. I do want to, in looking at your background here, you got your start, my understanding, you got your start in the field of medicine at age 16 with the local American Legion Ambulance.
That's correct.
Then ended up with dual majors in college, biology and psychology, but then you got an MBA. And then you ended up joining the Air National Guard, the New York Air National Guard's 106th Air Rescue Wing. And then finally in 1997, you decided to pursue a medical degree. So talk us through that entire background. That is quite diverse. Starting out in medicine, biology and psychology in college, then you get an MBA, you join the Air National Guard. What brought you back to medicine?
Well, I really started in medicine, and it's one of those things where you try everything else and then realize you had it right in the first place. So the American Legion Ambulance in Hampton Bays, these were at that time, it was 1979, so these were all World War II vets. We had a couple of World War I vets, and the Vietnam guys weren't crazy about the American Legion at that time, so we only had a few. But the World War II vets, pardon me, I'm post-shift, so you just have to bear with me here a little bit with the voice.
Oh, goodness.
World War II vets were just, they were like, yeah, I was chasing Nazis down at your age, so yeah, let's go. So they didn't have a problem with a 16-year-old out on the ambulances. I got my EMT at 18, one of the youngest EMTs in New York State. I actually ran with a guy, Renee Klager, who was the oldest EMT in New York State. He was a World War II vet. Did Binghamton, as you'd mentioned, degrees in biology, psychology, did a little electron microscopy when I was kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do, got the MBA. And then I went, as the Australians would say, walkabout, kind of didn't want to go straight to medical school. So really, you know, did the MBA, worked on Wall Street for a little while doing computers for Chase Bank, worked on a whale and seal stranding team, volunteered really on a whale and seal stranding team. But the common thread through this whole thing was working on the ambulances. You know, I got higher and higher levels up to paramedic, what we in New York State called an EMT-4, which is not quite a paramedic, but it does everything the same. And realized, you know, after a while, it's like, yeah, I got it wrong. I need to get back to medicine. And Stony Brook was perfect. You know, I was helping raise my nephew at the time, and it was right in my backyard. So got in there. and Jefferson for my residency, you know, level one trauma center at Thomas Jefferson University. So I've been very fortunate. I've had a really neat, you know, kind of spread. And the New York Air National Guard, I started in pararescue, but because of my vision, I couldn't stay in pararescue. So I wound up as a commander's advisor, you know, kind of hunting down racists and doing alcohol abatement and drug abatement for the Air National Guard. Actually, I trained in Knoxville in my officer candidate school.
You know, that it really is quite a background. Did you enjoy Knoxville? How long were you here?
I've been here, been there intermittently for different things. Yes, very much enjoyed Knoxville. Knoxville is just a terrific town.
It is.
So we were here for a couple months during officer candidate school, and we were back. You guys hosted what they call Destination Imagination Finals. So we've been back periodically and for other reasons, conventions and stuff like that. So I've always had a good time. My wife is a Nashville-born woman, so we have a lot of reason to be in Tennessee. So, but yeah, I love Tennessee, love Knoxville.
Well, there's a lot to be said for that background where you kind of pursued a lot of different things, but then you ultimately came around to medicine. Now, your specialty is you're an emergency room physician. And, you know, the ER is the first line of care, typically, especially in emergency situations. Emergency departments are designed to handle a very wide range of medical emergencies, from trauma and heart attacks to strokes and acute infections. But talk to us some about the challenges, Dr. Forrestal, that care providers face in not only knowing about but diagnosing and treating such a wide variety of possible ailments. I would think that's more part of the attraction, is you deal with so many things.
Yeah, it's, you know, emergency medicine is absolutely not for everybody. You know, I've known some providers in specialty services who want no part of the ER just because it can go off the hinge anytime. July 4th, 2 years ago, we were having a fairly steady, you know, 4th of July. We had a couple of firecracker injuries, a few things like that. And just out of the blue, we get eight gunshot wounds. Six rolled through the door. They all jumped in one car and came in by private vehicle. They all came through the front door. And then one that came in by ambulance. And then the other one, I'm really not sure how they got here. But in 30 seconds, it went from steady to just chaos, you know. And the security guys were actually kind enough to tell us that actually in 2 minutes, we had everybody in a bed. And in 2 hours, we had the emergency department back to its regular operating standard. So you have to love that, you know, that anything can come through at any time and in any numbers. And, you know, it's we ask of our emergency departments that they be able to do that, you know, just turn on a dime, coming with a heart attack, stroke, sepsis, gunshot wound, all of it. And we get this, and I my practice environment, I actually work in different types of centers. So I work in one critical access place where you see maybe 2-3 patients a night, but they can be quite sick. I work in a community center, which is fairly steady, does about 30,000 visits a year, and then a level 3 trauma center where we see over 90,000 people a year. So we'll get the full gamut of it. So, yeah, it's always challenging. It's always great.
And we're going to, you know, that's impressive. You got all that done and then back to normal within 2 hours. Some of the demand at emergency services around the country are creating real problems with some of those things. And we're going to get into a lot of that in this show. But before we do, I just want to ask you a couple more questions about your experience. What are some of the most difficult clinical decisions you have to make under pressure?
I think that we, you know, it pretty much it's A to Z, cradle to grave. You know, I have delivered children or helped to deliver children during a CPR on a mother who had overdosed. You know, it's we are asked to do pretty much everything. And, you know, we have to be resourced to be able to do that. And that doesn't always happen. We don't always get the resource to do it. So the challenge of it is trying to do this very demanding, you know, job where you really have to be able to handle anything, but you're not always given the resources, you know, and you want to do right by the families. You know, there's nothing worse than saying to a family, it's like, you know, I'm sorry it didn't work out. And, you know, we hate the idea that should ever be because we didn't have the tool, whatever that tool might be.
That's so I think that word.
Yeah, it's you know, it's these are the ER doesn't belong to me. It doesn't belong to the hospital. It belongs to the community. You know, so we really, you know, how much do you want your ER to be able to do in your community? You know, and like I said, we don't always look at it that way, and we don't always fund it that way. We don't always staff it that way. So there's probably the biggest challenge to my mind is accomplishing that performance at the highest levels with not always having everything you need to do so.
We're visiting with Dr. Kerry Forrestall this morning. He is an emergency room physician. We had him on in the spring about his book, Crushing Cancer. Today we're talking about some of the challenges in the emergency room system in our country. When we come back, we're going to get into some of those challenges. You know, the amount of non-urgent care that has to go on and how that bogs down the system, overcrowdedness, the shutting of rural hospitals, the non-medical use and abuse of prescription drugs. So I want to get into all of this and more. So stay with us. We're visiting with Dr. Kerry Forrestall. This is Jim Brogan. You're listening to More Living here on News Talk 98.7 WOKI.
Welcome back to News Talk 98.7's Brogan Financial Studios, where Jim Brogan is coming to you live with important news and advice to help you achieve your dream retirement. Get ready to learn and live. Here's your host, Jim Brogan.
Welcome back to More Living here on News Talk 98.7 WOKI. We're visiting with Dr. Kerry Forrestall, and we're talking about, he's an emergency room physician. And where are you based right now, Dr. Forrestall?
I'm in Maryland, actually, at the moment. We've done Philly, Ohio, up New York, and we've been in Maryland now about 18 years.
And we're talking about some of the challenges in the emergency rooms and our healthcare system in general that we're going to dive into now. Dr. Forrestall, a substantial portion of emergency room visits are now classified as non-urgent. Some studies estimated this can be upwards of 30% of the people that go to the ER, non-urgent. Why do you think so many people use an ER instead of a regular physician or urgent care?
Well, the primary driver, I think, is that people don't have access to physicians or mid-level providers like nurse practitioners or physician assistants very often because of insurance purposes. We have a large number of people who are uninsured in the United States still. And, you know, if you need care, you know, you have to get it somewhere. The walk-in clinics will generally do the wallet biopsy. Can you pay the bill? And if they can't, if it's not an emergency, you know, they say, well, you know, I can't help you. If it is an emergency, they just send them over to the emergency department. Some of it is convenience stuff. We've had people come in and say, I just missed my doctor's appointment. I need, you know, to get my hypertensive medication, kind of refilled. But by and large, it's insurance that seems to be driving this part of it. So we see a lot of people who simply have no other place to go. There's a law, and I think it's a good law, but it's 1986, I think it was, the Omnibus Reconciliation under Reagan created what's called EMTALA, which is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, which requires us to treat, you know, to basically screen people, and if they are found to have a medical emergency, treat it. That's morphed a little bit to if you have a medical condition, you know, we need to take care of it. We can't just send you out and say, you don't have a medical emergency. So we treat those things. And it's puts a tremendous stress on the hospitals because a lot of that is uncompensated care. And they don't make any allowance for that. They say, well, you know, we're sorry that you gave away, you know, however many millions of dollars in care, but that's on you. So there's nothing for the hospitals, especially, let's say, the not-for-profit hospitals, where they can kind of deduct that from anything. They just kind of have to eat that, which makes it very, very difficult on keeping these hospitals open. We've lost enormous numbers of beds over the last two decades. So we're doing, you know, increasingly older, sicker, and larger population with fewer and fewer beds and facilities. So, you know, it's kind of the, I don't know how many whammies that is that double, triple, quadruple whammies, yeah, where we're taking care of people, having less resources to do so, less money to do so, you know, but the demand is ever increasing. So,
well, yeah, I was going to ask you about this federal law and it, you know, that requires you to do a medical screening and stabilize treatment for anyone with an emergency medical condition. But what I hear you saying is it's morphed even into if somebody has any medical condition, you're going to need to treat them in the ER if they walk.
Yeah, it's a kind of a tricky thing. I mean, think about it. A guy has hypertension and he comes in and he's like, yeah, you know, I lost my job. I lost my insurance because a lot of U.S. insurance is employment based. And he says, I need my hypertensive medications. Now, hypertension, chronic hypertension is not in and of itself a medical emergency. It's obviously a medical condition that needs to be treated. But if I don't treat the guy, he comes back with a stroke. What have I accomplished? So, you know, we realize that if we don't treat these things, the diabetes, the hypertension, you know, all of those things, if we don't get those treated, it's just going to turn into a disaster. So,
that's right.
You know, it's really being, you know, if we were penny wise and pound foolish, we say, oh, you know, go talk to your doctor about that when you get one. That's not going to work out. So we're trying by treating the people who are kind of chronic-y. You know, I do a lot of wound care. People can't get to wound care. You know, and if I don't treat that, it's going to get infected and it's going to turn into sepsis. So I can give the guy, you know, a course of antibiotics and some wound care, or I can wait until he gets septic, and then that's a however many tens of thousands of dollars admission in the ICU. So,
and
you know,
you mentioned,
we do a lot of preventive. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Well, you mentioned the cost component and the financial strain. And according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, 55%, so over half of an emergency physician's time is spent providing uncompensated care. Can you expand on some of the financial complications and the ramifications when it comes to emergency departments?
Yeah, just what we were talking about. The hospitals are closing. You know, it's this incredible juggle to try to keep this thing running, this emergency medicine and ERs running, when really, you know, it's the government requires us to provide this care. It's the biggest unfunded mandate in history. You know, where we're talking about billions, if not trillions of dollars over the time since 1986, when this kind of came into existence. And there are things that they could do to help the hospitals. You know, they can say for not-for-profit hospitals, give it as a refundable tax rebate, you know, so that they can take it as really it comes back to them as a grant so that they can expand services, not necessarily just ER. So let's say we have a thing in emergency medicine where our certifying agency is the American Academy of Emergency Medicine. I may have that wrong, but anyway, we have what's called the General Hospital of Emergency Medicine. And so let's say we have our General Hospital of Emergency Medicine, and they provide $1 million or $2 million in unfunded care, right? If that comes back to them by a federal grant, right, say, okay, you gave away that much money, we'll give that back to you in tax rebates, then they can open a clinic so that they can do that care, you know, that kind of non-critical care. They can do that hypertensive management, the diabetes management, the wound care management, take that load off of the ERs. So these are things that they could do to try to lessen the load on the ER so that you're not waiting in the waiting room, you know, for, oh God, I mean, it's if it's good, it's hours on end. So we had one in South Philly Methodist Hospital where people would wait in the waiting room for 24 hours.
That's awful.
Yeah. And yeah, what do you do? You know, there's only so many beds.
It's a real problem. Now, you mentioned hospital closures, and rural hospital closures particularly on the rise. Can you talk a little bit about the role that rural hospitals play in care and the risk of these rural hospitals closing and how that threatens Americans and then also the healthcare system?
Sure. So our rural hospitals are really, you know, we are where I am. We have our critical access hospital would mean that if it were to close, it would be 30 to 45 minutes for somebody to get to emergency care. So now if you're having a heart attack, those are pretty critical minutes.
Thanks.
If you're having a stroke,
yeah,
that's a window that closes very quickly. Trauma, if you're bleeding, if you've been shot, you know, it's not time that you have to give. Recently, Crozier closed up in, I think it was Delaware, and there was a guy who got shot probably a block from where the hospital was, like the week after it closed. And Crozier's not a – that's a whole different thing where private equity had gotten into the act and they bought this hospital, bankrupt it, and then closed it. But it does demonstrate the thing or the dynamic where if you don't have care immediately accessible – it's going to go badly. So this young guy now was a block from a hospital that could have handled this problem. He had to be transported 40 minutes and he died 30 minutes into the transport. right? So these sorts of things, you know, we want to make the kind of blanket of emergency care where you can get to it quickly if you need it. And as they close these things, it creates care deserts. They're basically, you cannot get to care. Not everybody has a car. Not everybody has access to a car or somebody who can bring them around. So what do? You know, maybe you try some telemedicine. You get on, a Zoom call with somebody who can't lay hands on you, can't listen. A lot of medicine is what we see, not necessarily only what's said. I pick up a huge number of clues just being able to go hands-on with a patient. All of that's gone, and maybe they Google you, or rather Amazon you, some antibiotics or a hypertensive. It's just terrible medicine. So as we see the finances drawing down in the United States, and especially with HB1 that's just come through, it's going to take a lot of money out of Medicaid. It is right now, it is blown up. What is going to happen in 2027? We don't know what happens next. In Maryland, we had this very kind of forward-thinking pattern of payment, which we called the global waiver or global budget, which kind of made Medicare, Medicaid, and the insurers all pay a certain amount. It was very good at being able to predict what hospitals were going to have year to year to work with. That's all gone. They worked on this new system that was going to replace the old budgeting system for 5 or 10 years. I forget what it was, and it's gone. Nobody actually knows what payments are going to look like in Maryland come January. So, you know, hospitals have already closed, and there was one out in Kansas that just said, yeah, we were on the ropes as it was. There's no way we can do this. And then, of course, the biggest one is what's going to happen when that Medicaid cut gets to the nursing homes, because something like 60 to 80% of nursing home funding goes through Medicaid. Where are these people going to go? We know a lot of them are going to land in the ER. You know, they're going to say, okay, well, we brought grandma home, but we can't handle her, so we brought her to the ER, which is the classic. And where do we put them? So,
there's a real problem. It seems to me like some of the mandates that have happened, and then the numbers of gross uninsured in the country has created almost this perfect storm where we just can't. I mean, and you have an unfunded mandate from the government, as you said, and I'd never really thought of it that way, but it is an unfunded mandate that you have to care for people. Which, you know, I mean, that's great. People can get care, but it's creating so much stress on the system. One thing I do want to ask you about, Dr. Forrestal, is, you know, we're seeing a lot more hospital mergers and acquisitions. And one thing, when I look at that brings questions to my mind, it's not about the M&A activity specifically, but if I look at the categories of hospitals, it seems like there's three main categories from my perspective. You have independent hospitals. You have teaching hospitals. Here in Knoxville, we have the University of Tennessee, which is a teaching hospital. Now, then we have corporate-run hospitals. So from your advantage, what are the advantages or disadvantages for both physicians and patients alike with these three different kinds of structures?
So the big one, I'm going to go a little off on the direct question here, because it brings up a really important, there's an important differential. You were talking about corporate hospitals, and yeah, you know, corporate hospitals, some are well-run, some are not so well-run, but the real danger in medicine, emergency medicine especially, but in hospital care, is the private equity guys coming in and buying up hospitals. So what that means is, okay, so if you have, like, you know, the big one down in Tennessee is Healthcare Association, right? So the hospital, HCA, and they run a lot of hospitals.
Right out of Nashville.
Yeah, and they do a fine job. But then you have guys like Blackstone who come in and they buy up hospitals. So here's the trick that they do. So let's say you take, like, Crozier, we were talking about. Crozier owned its property. It was running. It was doing okay. Not great, but it was doing okay. And along comes the private equity group. I forget their names off the top of my head, but they buy the hospital, right? Because the hospital maybe gets into some straits. They find a buyer, and then the property gets sold out from underneath them. So now the property that they own, they're paying rent on, which eventually bankrupts Crozier, and they have to close. So then the hospital then has gotten all the money from the rent, and it's getting money from the sale of all the stuff. And they make a lot of money. Private equity makes a lot of money buying a hospital, basically bankrupting it, and then selling it off. Meanwhile, the people in the community, like our young man who got shot, they're out of luck. And that's happening all across the United States. So the big, in top of everything else that we were just talking about, we have huge numbers of unemployed or uninsured people, and we have all of these pressures on it. We now have this group coming in saying, like, oh, you're on the ropes. We can help out. And, you know, they buy the hospital and then no more hospital. So, you know, it's the independent hospitals, it's getting tough. You know, it's there's just too much going on for a single entity to kind of survive on its own. Hospital groups, you know, they band together and you get some economies of scale there. You can buy things more cheaply if you buy more of them, all that sort of thing. Large hospital chains, you know, they take that to the next level and they do okay. But the thing that just came out, and I can, on the next break, I'll look it up, see if I can find the reference for you. But they actually did a study showing that patient mortality increases when private equity has purchased the hospital or the hospital chain.
There's been studies that have shown that.
Yes. Yeah, there have been.
So, yeah.
And like I said, there are a lot of things that we know affect patient care negatively, but we can't really get anybody to listen. You know, we know that there are things, hospital, you know, patients who have to board in the emergency department. I mean, that's really our conversation today was kind of derived from a conversation about ER boarding when we were talking about the Crushing Cancer book. And the ER boarding is associated with increased mortality because you're sitting in a bed when you should be up on a floor getting, you know, specialty services, but you're sitting in an ER. So the more backed up we get with beds in the hospital, the more time people spend in the ER, the worse the outcomes. And all of these are things that we know about that we can do. We've studied these things endlessly. We know what the solutions are. We just have to get the politicians to say, okay, we'll do it. And we could have a much better, you know, medical system for everybody. We pay twice the amount worldwide. For our 11 peers of people who are as developed as we are in the world, we pay double what everybody else does, and we're in 11th place. We get the worst outcomes of these 11 peer countries. We have a shorter lifespan by about 7 years. You know, so there's a lot that we can do, you know, if we listen to the people who do this for a living.
Well, there's most certainly a lot of challenges. You know, it kind of goes back to the classic debate of is healthcare a right or a privilege? It really is a right, I think, but there are a lot of complications with how you fund that. I mean, it's one of the growing, it's really the big albatross in terms of government funding. When you look at the unfunded liabilities for Medicare, prescription drugs, and Medicaid, you know, everybody talks about the worries about Social Security, but the Medicare and healthcare issue is so much, in my view, so much of the elephant in the room. We're visiting with Dr. Kerry Forrestal, and I'm sorry, go ahead, doctor.
Oh, no, I was going to say, yeah, you know, it's the debate on healthcare being a right or a privilege, you know, I guess if, you know, you started to have chest pain, which would you want it to be?
Yeah. I completely agree, you know.
Yeah, it's the old atheist and foxholes thing. It's like, you know, it's an interesting intellectual debate to have, but when it comes down to it, don't we want our loved ones to be able to access care when they need it?
You know, I have to say, I'm going to tell you something very interesting about my upbringing that I don't know that I've ever really said on the air, but when I turned 25 years old, I was very accident prone growing up. So when I turned 25 years old, I had been to the emergency room 13 times. And just so you know, these were not going in with non-acute things. But the one that... I mean, I got run over by a car one time in my driveway. Ooh, wow. I mean, it just one thing after another, broken bones. But the one I'll never forget, it's just kind of a trying to provide a little bit of levity here. I was over at the University of Tennessee, and I was playing flag football. And I went deep on a pass, and I caught the ball, but I was off balance because I kind of had to lean out and stretch for the ball, and I fell down, and the guy behind me jumped over me, and his foot came right through my face.
Oh,
and it shattered my nose. And so my nose was literally had was moved over to the right side of my face. And literally by the time I got up, the front of my shirt was covered and was red. So the UT police got called. They called me. They took me to UT Hospital. And I'll never forget walking in, and I said, I need to see somebody. And the lady at the front desk said, "So you've got a bloody nose." And I was like, well, I mean, my nose is on the side of my face. And anyway, it was just kind of a funny thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I did have a lot of experience with emergency rooms growing up. But I tell you what, we're going to come back, and I want to get into things like the overcrowded issues, and but also things like the misuse of prescription drugs, the importance of our emergency care in terms of handling what seems to be an increase in natural disasters. So stay with us. We're visiting with Dr. Kerry Forrestall. This is More Living with Jim Brogan here on News Talk 98.7 WOKI.
Welcome back to News Talk 98.7's Brogan Financial Studios, where Jim Brogan is coming to you live with important news and advice to help you achieve your dream retirement. Get ready to learn and live. Here's your host, Jim Brogan.
This is More Living with Jim Brogan, where it's all about living the best years of your life your way. We're with you every Saturday, 9 to 10 a.m., and again from 3 to 4 p.m. You can also podcast us on Spotify or Apple Podcast. We will have today's show up by Tuesday afternoon. We've got several years' worth of shows on our website. Also, our dollars and cents segments are all podcast on our website. You can go to broganfinancial.com and click on radio to be able to stream all of that content. Today, we're visiting with Dr. Kerry Forrestall. We're talking about the emergency room crisis, the emergency department crisis in America. And I'm going to dive into a couple of things in terms of our staffing and the challenges for ER doctors themselves. But before I do get into that, Dr. Forrestall, let's talk about prescription drugs. The non-medical use and abuse of prescription drugs, as we know, has become a bigger and bigger problem over the last few decades. Experts estimate that more than 18 million people, 12 and up, age 12 and up, will have used prescription drugs for non-medical reasons in the previous year. Do you see a lot of people drug-seeking in the ER, and what drugs are they looking for, and how do you manage that?
Yeah, actually, we've had some success here. So we call it non-therapeutic drug-seeking behavior, and we've had a lot of problems with that over time, you know, where I think of all the opioid deaths, something like 20% of them came from pills, not fentanyl or street heroin, For our system, we did a few things. One of the medications that gives you a big hit is Dilaudid. And we just simply said, we're not going to use Dilaudid anymore. We took it out of our formulary in the ER. And we found that in that, to my mind, I don't have any study to prove this, but to my mind, I felt like my wrestling matches with drug seekers just fell through the floor. You know, we also have something in Maryland called the CRISP database, Chesapeake Regional Information, something, something. But it basically allows me to track every opioid prescription that is written in the Delmarva Peninsula area. So if I see a guy who's got 14 different scripts from 14 different guys, I can go to him and say, look, you know, I know you got a headache, but I see that you're getting meds from everywhere, and that's just not a thing we're going to do.
That's a huge flag, right?
Yeah, that's a huge flag for us. And, you know, it has worked. You know, I can't tell you, you know, it still happens, but it doesn't happen nearly as much as it used to, where people would come to the emergency department. Now, some of that is, unfortunately, the availability of street drugs is just, I mean, I don't know where these people get this stuff from, where they can just go, it feels like any corner and get fentanyl. You know, and they can get heroin, and they can get cocaine and methamphetamine and whatever else. And I'm like, where do you get this? But it seems to be readily available. So in the ER, we're very tight-fisted with narcotics. If you have a broken bone, if we cut on you for an abscess or something else, we will give you 12 pills. You will have 12 Percocet or 12 Vicodin or Norco that you can go home with, and then you have to talk to your doctor if you need more pain management than that. So, and I think that's created a barrier to people seeking narcotics in the emergency department. Not completely, but at least it's been, it puts up a headwind. I mean, are you really going to go through, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours of waiting around to get 12 pills of Norco? You know, and it seems, I can't say that that's what's worked, but it feels to me like we're wrestling less. You know, and then the other side of that is that we're actually seeing now declines in the number of people dying of opioids. And I think a big part of that is not only what we're doing, but the now we can get Narcan over the counter. You don't need a prescription. You can go into a drugstore and pick up Narcan injectors. And they're good, you know, for a very long time. There's an expiration date on it, but I think there was some study that like 10 years later, it was still 80% effective. So the ready availability of Narcan in the injectors, they're like $44 for 2 injectors. But if you have somebody in your life who is got a problem, maybe with drugs or a few things, that's $44 well spent. And very often, if you go through the pharmacy, you know, your insurance may even pick it up. So we're making headway there.
So you're on the actual front line of the emergency department. And so what I'm hearing is from someone on the front line, our issues, at least as far as what you're seeing in emergent care with the misuse of prescription drugs, we're starting to have some progress on it. And that's very refreshing to hear. I do want to ask you about the importance, as we all know, of emergency care when it comes to the frequency and severity of natural disasters. Of course, that can have a severe impact on emergency departments. How does an emergency department help during a disaster, and how does it impact your ability to provide services for other emergent needs going on at the time?
Yeah, we're very lucky here in Delmarva where we haven't really gotten clobbered by a lot of things. We're not a tornado area. We don't really get huge snowstorms maybe once in a while, and I've seen one hurricane in the 18 years I've been here. So we're kind of in this sweet spot where we don't get hit like that a lot. But then there are things like, you know, 7 people at a party get shot, and, you know, you have, which is not a natural disaster, of course. But ERs in places where they do have that, you know, it's they just like with my guys when they got shot, we just adapt. You know, we just use what we have at hand and, you know, we make do. It's kind of a non-specific answer, right? But, you know, it's what's the specific what's the specific disaster? And we rise to the occasion. People come in when they're not on shift. We open up parts of the hospital or whatever else. We just gear up and take care of whatever we have to. It's just an ethos in emergency medicine where, what do you got? You know, what do you need me to do?
So, you know, I think that's a fantastic word, and that's exactly what we need to hear, because the people that are emergency medicine, you're there ultimately to serve people, and you adapt, you figure out a way. And, even with all the challenges that we have. Dr. Forrestal, in 2025, 56% of emergency medicine physicians have reported burnout, with an additional 25% indicating they also experienced depression, according to a survey led by Medscape. And notably, 63% of emergency medicine physicians surveyed stated that they would accept less pay for improved work-life balance. Talk about the challenge of being on the front line and being a physician with all the challenges that we're talking about.
So, yeah, it's, you know, when they talk about policy, it's a very abstract thing. It's not face-to-face with the people who are suffering. You know, the thing that we have to do in ER medicine is, you know, let's say somebody closes down a clinic or something like that, and they go, oh, you know, well, okay, the clinic is gone. And nobody thinks very much about that. But I see the people who that affects. I've had to deal with, like, for example, we were talking about being able to get your medicines. I've had to tell the family members of a man who is 30 some odd years old, who died from, you know, his hypertension and heart disease. He wasn't treating himself very well, but he could have survived, but he couldn't get access to the stuff. And I had to tell this mother that her son, who should have another 40, 50, 60 years on the planet, is dead. You know, so we have to deal with the face of that. She collapsed on the floor and crawled under a table, and I had to crawl under with her, trying to console her on my hands and knees, saying, you know, like, you know, this is not, you know, she's thrashing around, hitting her head. Ah, you know, I have to see what the face of these decisions looks like. I have to say, you know, we have not, we're not doing great on mortality for fetuses or for infants and mothers. And I'm the one who has to tell the families, I'm sorry, you know, that this baby's not going to live, you know, it's not going to live a life, you know? So it's this disconnect that we shout and we say, this is how it could be better. You know, we need to get people insurance, and that's not a political thing. That's just from a fiscally conservative thing. If we have better coverage for people, it costs us less. You know, we have Medicare and Medicaid have a 2% overhead administrative cost, where privates have 18 to 20. We can save billions of dollars and make better care and better outcomes for our populations. And all of that's that high level stuff, but we deal with it on the day to day family thing. So I can see, you know, I don't know of any ER doc that hasn't burned out a few times anyway. You know, and depression, and I've had at least one colleague commit suicide.
That's awful. You know, well, I view what you all do, certainly all doctors to a degree are really in ministry to the people that they serve, and certainly be on the front line of the ER. It's very much you're serving people. So I want to thank you for all that you do. Before we wrap up, I do want to just real quickly, we had you on in the spring. You're an emergency room physician. You published a book, Crushing Cancer. Why does an emergency room physician write a book on cancer? And give us the 30-second executive summary and let us know how people can get the book.
Sure. So to the first part of it, one, we see a lot of cancer problems in the emergency department, things that could have been avoided if people had better information. Two, you know, is that we diagnose a lot of it, and I really wanted to do more than just say to somebody, hey, you got this problem. I wanted to give them a set of resources to be able to deal with that problem that went outside the emergency room setting, right? ER is like, you know, we do things in an hour or so. And then three, it's big in my family. And the executive summary would be, so Crushing Cancer, right? It's a patient's complete guide to managing a cancer diagnosis. That's the full name. And it's just that. It's not you're going to take Keytruda for liver cancer. That's your oncologist's job. So what we talk about is how do you keep your lights on? You know, how do you deal with the finances? What are the resources? You know, how do you deal with the legal things? How do you deal with the interpersonal things? How do you deal with the workplace issues? You know, how do you deal with all of those things? So it's basically the new, we got, the book got signed by Springer Publishing. So we're going into our second edition. And it's basically everything that you need from the day of diagnosis through, you know, it's in the rearview mirror and you've beaten it. So it's everything you need to know about how your life will kind of get and how to manage it best while you're going through cancer care.
So I guess just go online, Google Crushing Cancer, Dr. Forrestal, people can pull it up and be able to order it.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we were, just to jump back for a second to the, one of the things that we were talking about with all of this was the ER boarding. And, you know, if we could talk about that for 2 seconds.
Yes, we just need to make it quick.
Okay. I can actually make this quick because ER boarding is not complicated. ER boarding is actually very simple. So we don't have the beds and the nurses to fill the beds upstairs to take care of people. So people sit in the emergency department and take up beds that we need to treat the people who are coming in with the new problem. It's a very simple fix. Fund nurses, fund beds, and you will get rid of ER waiting.
That's a great word. Dr. Forrestal, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule at the end of a night shift, it sounds like, to share your wisdom. And again, thank you for all that you do in serving your community.
Thanks, and I hope we talk again soon.
Absolutely. That's Dr. Kerry Forrestal, wrote the book Crushing Cancer, Emergency Room Physician. We're about out of time. We are going to go to break, and we come back. I'm going to have a very short financial tip. The 4% rule, can you take 4% out of your retirement account in year one of retirement? Can you maybe take more? Is there new data that indicates with the right investment plan you could maybe take more? So stay with us. This is More Living here on News Talk 98.7 WOKI.
Welcome back to News Talk 98.7's Brogan Financial Studios, where Jim Brogan is coming to you live with important news and advice to help you achieve your dream retirement. Get ready to learn and live. Here's your host, Jim Brogan.
Thanks for tuning in this week to More Living here on News Talk 98.7. WOKI. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I was going to do a tip about the 4% rule. How much can you truly take out in your retirement for income if you have a plan to support that? Tell you what, we're going to dive into the 4% rule next week. How can you turbocharge the 4% rule and maybe even take more and have it adjusted for inflation? Thanks for tuning in this week. You've been listening to More Living with Jim Brogan here on News Talk 98.7 WOKI.
The views expressed by Jim Brogan and his guests are not that of Cumulus Media. Any discussion of financial, legal, and tax planning strategies is not intended to be individualized advice and is general in nature. Always consult with your advisor for advice specific to your needs. This program's content does not represent a recommendation of any particular security, strategy, or investment by Jim Brogan or Brogan Financial Incorporated.